disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, May 1st, 2019. Happy May Day! In this episode, we start off by speaking with anti-fascists from Long Beach Antifa about recent mobilizations against the far right in Southern California that took place last weekend. We then transition to a critical discussion on current events in the recent Zizek versus Jordan Peterson debate. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. Another alt-right mass shooting sadly took place last weekend in Southern California when a 19-year-old man, after posting on 8chan, opened fire into a synagogue, killing one person and injuring several more. The shooting comes only days after President Trump doubled down on comments in support of Unite the Right marchers in Charlottesville, Virginia, and only weeks after Trump downplayed the threat of white nationalism following the New Zealand massacre. Under pressure from the Trump administration, the Mexican state is blocking migrants from crossing its territory to get into the U.S. It is also housing migrants in its own detention facilities. According to The Guardian last Thursday, quote, more than 1,000 migrants broke out of a detention center in southern Mexico on Thursday evening, authorities said, in a fresh sign of how a surge in arrivals have stretched the country's resources to the limit. In so-called Vancouver in Canada, a 71-year-old grandfather took part in a tree sit against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. He lasted 34 hours in the trees before coming down, was then arrested. He stated to the press, quote, I am more afraid of climate change than I am of jail. I am willing to risk arrest to send a message to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Canada shouldn't be building more dirty pipelines. This project doesn't have the consent of many of the First Nations it passes through, and thousands of people, including myself, aren't going to stand by and let it get built. In Raleigh, North Carolina, there was a banner drop for a young man that was murdered by the police earlier this month. Students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, held a massive walkout and strike in the face of several students going to court over the toppling of the Silent Sam statue. In San Jose, California, a call-in campaign was successful in kicking out the Border Patrol from an on-campus job fair. In New York, members of the Metropolitan Anarchist Coordinating Council, or MAC, held a pre-May Day family-friendly event in Tompkins Square Park. Also in New York, Ash J on Twitter reports that people took over, quote, Whitney Museum in New York City as protesters demand the freedom of Puerto Rican political prisoners. They're also demanding that Warren Canders, whose company Safari Land makes tear gas, which is used against Puerto Ricans, step down from the museum's board. After 42 days on hunger strike, the Mexican government committed to reviewing the cases of indigenous prisoners in Chiapas who were tortured to extract confessions. The Workers Initiative for Liberation and Defense in Colorado, who we have interviewed on this program before about their mutual aid program, held a massive event recently with over 400 people showing up for their outside community meal, free store, and gathering. In Seattle, anti-fascists organized a poster campaign to out to organizers of Identity Europa / American Identity Movement. At Swarthmore University, located outside of Philadelphia, students occupied and communalized a frat house after documents were leaked showing its long history of homophobia, racism, and misogyny. In response, members of the fraternity decided to disband the frat. In Portland, people again blocked tracks against fossil fuels. At Harvard, banners were dropped against the university's involvement in prison labor. The Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club intervened at a recent gun rights rally in the Pacific Northwest by handing out anti-fascist flyers, condemning organizers such as Joey Gibson and Matt Shea. Appalachians Against Pipelines reports, quote, as MVP keeps trying to bury the pipeline and undermine the resistance, spring in the mountains is bursting from the ground, twisting through the undergrowth and whirling among the trees. We're still in the canopy and among the streams, and we're not backing down. Today, Holden is still in jail facing a ridiculous threat of terrorism charge after being arrested Thursday for locking down to welding equipment. Another person sentenced for locking down to a drill rig is now on their fourth day of a hunger strike. Both have been able to communicate and say they're doing fine. Today, the tree sits on Yellowfinch remain, as they have since the last summer, a confirmation of the resilience of the struggle. And now, some upcoming events. On May 4th, there's an all-out mobilization in Toronto against anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant groups. On May 4th, there is a Nazi suck potluck at the Silent Sam Hole at UNC Chapel Hill. On May 9th, the Portland Anarchist Black Cross is hosting an open house. On May 18th, there is a mobilization against the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. On May 25th, there is a mass mobilization against the KKK in downtown Dayton, Ohio. From May 18th through the 19th, come out to the Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism or ROAR Conference in the Bay Area of California. From May 30th through June 3rd, there is the Earth First Regional Rendezvous in Hudson Valley. In June, be on the lookout for Running Down the Walls events benefiting Anarchist Black Cross chapters across the U.S. On June 12th through the 19th, there is the Save the Mattole Forest Direct Action Convergence in Northern California. On June 14th through the 17th, there is the Fight Toxic Prisons Conference in Gainesville, Florida. On June 15th through the 23rd, there is the Wild Roots Feral Futures Convergence happening in Southwest Colorado. On June 19th, there is an anti-fascist mobilization against the Nationalist Solutions Conference in Tennessee. On August 3rd through the 11th, there is the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking Convergence in Worcester, Massachusetts. And finally, on August 16th through the 18th, in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona, there is the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence. That's going to do it for us today. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussions, and we'll see you next time. Happy May Day.
May Day, kicking it. At this barbecue, chilling with my folks, like everyday people do. But running through my mind, I got a different picture. So I grab the mic just to spit some scripture. My mind gets carried away to Chicago, the turn of the century. All of the bravado built up by the bosses was starting to slip, because ordinary folks who were sick of taking shit were starting to organize, building up unions. Anarchists on the front lines, building the movement for the 8-hour day, dignity and respect. And so the bosses got pissed. I mean, what would you expect? They sent the police in to start murdering folks. There was a rally in Haymarket in the chaos and smoke. Somebody threw a bomb which killed six cops, either an act of desperation or a terrorist plot. It's the long dark night, the sleep of reason, that would take an honest man trying for treason. The reason that folks are so scared to speak, and before we've even started, we've admitted defeat. Just the fear and the rage at living in a cage. Bullshit we read on the front page. I can feel it from my bones to my sinews, but the everyday world still continues. So the pigs went nuts and started rounding up radicals, claiming that the bomb was thrown by anarchist fanatical. The perfect excuse to start cracking some heads. They finally charged a man and wanted all of them dead. Now not a single shred of evidence was ever produced. Four were executed by the hangman's noose, and Louis Ling, who was the most militant, committed suicide so the pigs couldn't kill him. The other three were released years later when the new governor finally looked at the data. John Peter Outgale wrote up the pardons and indicted the system, which he was a part of. The capital crooks never forgave him, and they used the newspapers to make people hate him. It ended his career, but he still did the right thing while the workers kept working and they kept organizing. It's the long dark night, the sleep of reason, that would take an honest man trying for treason. The reason that folks are so scared to speak, and before we've even started, we've admitted defeat. Just the fear and the rage at living in a cage. The bullshit we read on the front page, I can feel it from my bones to my sinews, but the everyday world still continues. Now it's a century later, the struggle's still going on, we're still getting fucked. The pigs are still going strong, and nowadays I got this new Patriot Act designed to describe how all the patriots should act. But looking at the facts, you got a very different picture. It's all about control, so don't let the pigs get you. Indefinite detentions, no right to a trial, violations of a privacy, the total denial of every freedom that Bush claims to be protecting. John Kerry helped write it, so on closer inspection, it should be pretty obvious just who owns the system. I think every sane person has the duty to resist them. Of course, anarchists are still up in the struggle, our dreams still intact as we're soaring through the rubble of the way things could have been, should have been, and will be. We'll never stop working to stop organizing. It's the long dark night, the sleep of reason, that would take an honest man trying for treason. The reason that folks are so scared to speak, and before we've even started, we've admitted defeat. Just the fear and the rage at living in a cage. The bullshit we read on the front page, I can feel it from my bones to my sinews, but the struggle for freedom continues.
Okay, we're going to be talking about two anti-fascist mobilizations that happened over the weekend in so-called Southern California, one in Huntington Beach and the other in Long Beach, California. Do you all just want to introduce yourselves real quick?
Yeah, we're with Long Beach Antifa.
Awesome. Hey. Thanks for joining us. You know, just real quick, if you can kind of give us a context of what's been happening in terms of, I guess, especially anti-fascist organizing in Southern California. I mean, kind of from an outsider's perspective, like if you've just been watching the media, you might have seen stuff about like groups like RAM have been active down there. Obviously, people have seen like images from Huntington Beach a couple years ago of just like kind of large crowds of Trump supporters beating the crap out of, you know, several kids with, you know, anti-Trump signs and stuff like that. How would you describe the terrain in the last couple of years down there?
Well, the first thing to understand is that Los Angeles Metro is huge. We have shitty transportation. We're car culture here, right? So if people live in Los Angeles or live up in the Valley, to get down to Huntington Beach or other places is really difficult unless you have a car. So kind of with that perspective, we're kind of, for the longest time, we were kind of isolated down here in Long Beach. There weren't any other groups. We were trying to organize. But I think a lot of leftist groups up here are really hard to work with. So once you get those groups that you're willing to work with, you stick to them and you work with them. What else?
I think that, you know, there's kind of, I think that, kind of like what's been going on across the rest of the country is kind of going on here as well. Since 2016, we've seen, kind of like these people coming out of the woodwork and, excuse me. So we've been slowly watching a few groups coalesce, one being the UPNF, the United Patriot National Front, which is Antonio Foreman and Drake Neiswanger. So they were actually the organizers for the event in Long Beach. The event in Huntington Beach was kind of more of like a, not necessarily alt-right, but kind of far-right anti-immigrant group. And, you know, for us, it's important to show up because, you know, Huntington Beach is pretty deep behind the Orange Curtain, which is pretty solidly enemy territory.
What do you mean by that?
By enemy territory?
Sure.
There's just a long tradition of like skinhead activity down there, neo-Nazi activity. Even just as we were approaching the event in Huntington Beach this weekend, you know, we passed several American Identity Movement flyers and things like that. It's historically very typical to see that kind of stuff down there.
Gotcha. Okay. So there's a lot of far right and white nationalist activity that comes out of that area.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's important to note that the far right fascism is more in southern OC County, or Orange County, I should say. Other towns that are in Orange County are Santa Ana and Anaheim. And just a couple of years ago, there was a KKK rally in Anaheim where they stabbed three anti-fascist protesters.
Right.
So Anaheim has a history of the Klan. So they're trying, I mean, I don't know why they decided to come out of their little rat holes to have that protest, but they got shut down, you know, even though people got, you know, shed blood. So now Anaheim and Santa Ana have kind of undergone a demographic change. Used to be a lot, you know, mostly white. Now it's a lot, you know, it's heavily Latino now. So over the last 15, 20 years, it's changed.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's talk about what happened on Saturday. So there was a group of far right people. They held an anti-immigrant, anti-sanctuary state rally. How many people were on each side, and also just what happened? We know that there was, I think if you were watching the news, you saw a brawl, and also the police came in and arrested some people. So what all happened?
I mean, before we go too deep into it, I want to clarify that the police repression, or however you want to say it, there was pretty intense. The two of us were actually only on the ground for maybe, what, 30 minutes?
We had to get out quickly because they were after us.
I mean, but everything you mentioned, we definitely witnessed. But I would say, what would you say, maybe 100 on their side, maybe 50 on our side?
It's hard. I don't know how to gauge how many people were there. All I know is that we were outnumbered.
It was very intense. It's a little hard to just gauge the numbers just by that. But I would say...
That sounds about right.
Yeah, 50 to 100.
And there were about 15 in block, which that's probably the brawl you saw. It was just some random right winger that came. He clearly was there to instigate a fight, walking up to the masked individuals, asking them stupid questions. They got, they circled him, and then he started throwing punches. So, what happened after that was he got assaulted because he did manage to punch his way out.
He left, though. This is the live streamer troll. Or he was ejected from the space, I would say.
Yeah, he was. The cops basically, once they saved him, I remember seeing him sort of away from the crowd where he'd started his altercation. I didn't pay any attention as to whether he was escorted away, but I'm assuming he was because he wasn't around anymore.
Yeah, I think he dropped a piece of equipment or something like that, kind of deeper in the crowd, and was trying to get it back, and nobody was letting him back in, so he had to be carried away, basically, by the police.
And is that what caused the police to come over and arrest people?
So that, there were actually no arrests made at that moment. He threw the first punch, which is important, but yeah, there weren't any arrests made at that point. The police were still on horseback at that point. I think it was maybe 15 minutes later that they charged in on the horses and started making arrests. But as far as I could tell, none of the people actually involved in that original fight were arrested. I don't think it was different people.
What was the pretext? If there wasn't, it's not like they're gonna be like, here's why we're beating you. But
I mean, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but from my perspective, we were being targeted.
Right.
I mean, one piece of information that I think is interesting is we parked maybe 8 or 9 blocks away from where the actual event was, and then we're walking in, and within about 5 minutes of us parking, there was an officer on us trying to get photos.
Right.
He made a few like veiled threat kind of comments to our group. So from my perspective,
can you say what those were?
Like, welcome to Huntington Beach, and then pulled out his camera and started taking pictures of us. We weren't planning on walking over in block, but given the fact that we had an escort pretty much from the moment we set foot in the area, kind of became necessary.
And I'm assuming the far right people were not getting the same treatment.
At this event, I found it kind of fascinating. Normally, like up in LA or in Long Beach, you would kind of normally see the police kind of standing in the middle of the two groups, kind of squarely in the middle, at least pretending to kind of do the both sides thing. From my perspective, we essentially walked into a kettle at this event. The police were on horses, basically face to face with our side, with the counter protesters.
Right.
It was clearly a case of them trying to intimidate us.
They were truly pulling some brown shirt bullshit. That's for sure.
Yeah.
One thing, as my friend here is saying, is that we are if you notice from the video, there's a median on Pacific Coast Highway, and each side is 3 or 4 lanes wide, I think. The MAGA chuds would get into the middle divider there, and they would just taunt us, you know, waving their flag, saying whatever they were saying, and the cops ignored them.
Right.
But had we done that, oh, you could bet that they would have come down on us hard, you know, get in the middle, block any traffic. So that's,
or go across the street and try to like start a fight.
Yeah, we could never do anything like that.
They would have just been on us like flies to shit had that been the case.
Just judging from the fact that, I mean, it was, even though people were outnumbered, it was like 150. I mean, still, I think, you know, a couple years ago, maybe like right after Trump would have was elected or before, I feel like maybe those numbers would have been double on their side or even bigger.
I think I probably agree with that. I think that I think that there's been a little bit of steam lost on their side. I think just with seeing like Robert Rundo and Ram kind of get arrested or flee or whatever's going on with them. Like, I think that I think there's been a little bit of steam that's run out. I think though that more so than that, the kind of militant leftist scene, the anarchist scene in this area, I think has been coming together a lot since that rally with Ram. So I think, I don't know if I would necessarily say that their side would have been smaller, but I definitely think our side has grown, not just in size, but in militancy.
What would you say to people that would say, well, look, you know, there's 50 people to 100, you know, there's two sides, they're on even sides of the street. Like, why do you need 5 people in black with masks? You know, that just is going to give them something to focus on. You know, we might as well just stand here with our signs and then call it a day. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, in asking why do that? Why go and block? I mean, for us, we've definitely had people that were associated with be doxxed, and we've seen kind of what that can do to someone's life. You know, and it's not always like, it's not always material. Sometimes it's just that kind of fear that it can bring into your life. So
right.
For us, and, you know, the totality of the work that we do, it's important that we're not identified in that way. But I do want to say, and, you know, just I think it's important to be honest and self-critical about these things when you're like after they happen. We haven't had a chance to sit down. This has been a pretty difficult weekend for our group, and we haven't had a chance to sit down and talk about it, but we're not sure that that was the best tactic, to be really honest. It felt like we were targeted for it, and yeah, it's hard to know that except for in hindsight. But if I were personally to be self-critical, I would want to take a really hard look at why we chose that tactic in this instance. I mean, we were deep, like I said, we were deep behind the orange curtain, and that's really scary. You know, just being real.
I'd have to agree with that too. In retrospect, that it probably wasn't the best decision that we as organizers did. I think we should have just went in without masks, but then that puts people like both of us at risk.
And it's hard too, because I mean, I think any group of, I don't want to even say young people, but just like any group of people that like obviously is like together, you know, has some sort of bond. Like if, you know, 5 people walk into a demonstration and they're obviously have a purpose, I mean, they're going to be noticed by the police. It doesn't matter if you have a mask on. I mean, obviously you have masks on and you're all moving together. I mean, the police, I mean, that's who they're looking for. That's who they're trained to look for. I mean, that's kind of like what, you know, they're spoon fed about demonstrators is like, you know, these are the bad people. Anybody with a mask, you know, so obviously they're going to glom onto that. But I think, you know, beyond that, anybody that kind of comes with any sort of intention and like has some sort of cohesion as a group is, you know, going to be watched, obviously.
Just to add one more thing to the block or to that part of the conversation, I just want to say that, like, if you want to put this into other people listening out there, the decision to go to a protest in Black Bloc is very serious. It's not something you should do for social capital or to look cool or anything like that. It's a, you know, some of us have been around for a little while, and it's a very serious decision to make, and I think people need to know that.
And there's another aspect to it. When you go in block and you just look like you're in tattered clothing, you don't present that image of being militant. I know I have a couple of friends up in LA who are quite militant, and when they do some actions as security, they all look the same. They've got a vest, you know, they've got their tactical vest on, their tactical pants, their tactical boots. You know, if they have a helmet, if they're expecting whatever, they've got a helmet. So I think that's a problem with blocks. But I do understand that shit costs money, right? I mean, it's not cheap to go out and buy tactical gear. I totally understand that. But I think that's kind of a problem there, is that, you know, we just look like a bunch of thugs a lot of the times. We don't look militant. And I think that's maybe kind of one of the reasons why we were targeted. I think had we looked a lot more militant, we may have been left alone, but that's debatable.
Well, I mean, I think it's also a question politically of, like, you know, what side are the police looking at? You know, what side are the, you know, do they consider the outside agitators or the bad protesters to be? And I mean, I think we all know the answer to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a couple more questions on the Huntington Beach stuff. So just in terms of the far right, I mean, obviously Antonio Foreman was out there. You know, he marched in Unite the Right. He has a long history of, you know, posting stupid videos saying Hitler did nothing wrong, talking about, you know, kind of red-pilling and, you know, radicalizing patriot movement types more towards white nationalism. He was bodyguard for Baked Alaska for a long time. He seems to be doing that now for other people, like even people at InfoWars at different events. But I'm just curious, like, who was represented on the far right side? Was it just, like, you know, quote unquote mainstream Trump supporters? Were there far right groups that were out there? Just a smattering of fascists in the crowd? What did it look like?
There was another known kind of alt-writer, Arthur Shaper was there, if you're familiar with him. I think his group is Mass Resistance, I think is the name of it. Is that it?
I don't really know. There's just so many people.
Yeah, there's a lot down here. Anyways, Arthur Shaper kind of made his little bit of his name on YouTube doing... he would go to, like, city council meetings and harass immigrants and things like that and do things live on YouTube and gained a little bit of a following. He was there. I think he tried to speak after we left, but he was shouted down. So he was there, and
The adorable deplorable was there.
Yeah, the adorable deplorable. I can find.
They do. They're basically a, you know, gender fuck, right? And they play on that with the right wing, and it's like, I don't know how to explain it, but
right,
this person's fully accepted on that side, and they're a MAGA chud, you know.
See, we can hate trans people. We've got one.
Right.
It's basically
exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're, you know, a token essentially. But as far as far right groups, I was on the I was looking for Proud Boys. I was looking for Hammerskins. I was looking for the main ones, right? And I didn't see any of them. But we did. We were kind of. Don't forget that we ended up leaving a little bit earlier right, because we were being targeted. But we do know that towards the end, maybe you heard about the anarchist girl that was over on the MAGA side, just distracting them.
Uh-huh.
And he just played that whole distraction and distracted them and distracted them and distracted them. And they were asking her the event holders were asking the entire group to not pay any attention to her. And they just kept doing it. And I guess a couple of speeches were missed because she was just distracting everyone. So if anything, she did one hell of a job.
Yeah, whoever she is,
you
she
know, commend her. Yeah, she killed that site. It was. And this is secondhand account. We weren't there to witness it, but that's from videos and stuff that we saw afterwards.
Yeah, one of our comrades was one of the individuals that was arrested, and we basically had to leave immediately to start doing bail support for her.
Do you feel that there is like some sort of tension within people that would come out to these demonstrations, where before, like maybe before Unite the Right, or even after, that they would have been kind of fine sharing a space with white nationalists and people on the alt-right, and now they're maybe a little more worried, like, well, I don't really want to be seen with those people.
You mean for the right wingers?
Yeah.
Sorry, I think
it's hard to say.
I honestly think that, you know, it's like we were monitoring the Facebook discussion that the right was having for a while, and there was a little bit of a push to maybe like a couple of Proud Boys came in there and were like, oh, we're gonna show up and start shit, and there was a little bit of pushback, but as far as what I've seen on the ground, it looks to me more like they're almost in bold, like the kind of like the your run of the mill like Fox News conservative is a little bit emboldened by knowing that there's these people like the Proud Boys or American Identity Movement that are, you know, militant right wing activists. So that's what it looks like, at least on the ground to me. Like maybe they're trying to control the online conversation. So it,
At the Huntington Beach rally in 2017, when Ram was there, I mean, none of them were trying to stop anyone from getting beat up. I mean, there was a reporter that was beat up. No one on the right tried to stop anything. They just let Robert Rundo just pelt people in the face, you know? So, yeah. I don't know.
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, opacity and, like, how much people can basically tell themselves, like, oh, well, they're not Nazis, they're just... You know, because if you look at the people in Ram, they just look like, you know, quote, normal young people. Just,
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, these are skateboarders or what, you know, whatever. And I think, you know, after Unite the Right and after it becomes, basically they can't deny it anymore. Like, you can't look at Antonio Foreman and be like, yeah, he wasn't at Unite the Right. I mean, obviously he was. And there's all these videos of him saying, like, incredibly pro-Nazi Hitler stuff. So it's not like you can deny that. He can say, like, he's not like that anymore or whatever, but, I mean, so I just think it's harder for people to kind of, like, tell that story to themselves anymore. I mean, definitely it seems like in other parts of the country, after Unite the Right, I mean, that was Joey Gibson's whole thing, is that he was complaining always that, like, after Unite the Right, nobody wants to protest anymore because they don't want to be seen as a Nazi. But...
I mean, don't be a Nazi.
I would say, though, that, I mean, looking at this event, there's still a pretty pretty I don't know I'm searching for the word right now, but the movement down here is pretty comfortable with some serious vitriol, serious bigotry, I think, like the right wing movement. I mean, if you watch some of the videos, I mean, I'm almost less shocked when I see like a Proud Boy spouting that stuff off than I am when I look across the way and it's like, looks like your good childhood friend's mom is over there just like harassing a Mexican family, which happened. Like, you're just kind of like, that's what's most shocking to me about the movement down here, is it's almost like soccer moms that have just decided to go off the rails with their Fox News, InfoWars, whatever. Like,
yeah.
I mean, that was definitely at the Huntington Beach rally, that was definitely shocking to me.
For sure. So just last question before we kind of transition to Long Beach is just in terms of, you know, our side, you mentioned that it feels like people have kind of like come together a little more over the past couple of years. I'm curious if you can just speak to that.
I definitely think, like my partner said at the very beginning, it can be hard to organize in this part of the country. I think I used to live on the East Coast, and it was like there's public transit and people can get out and show up and make a show of force. And it's been traditionally hard to get people out. And I think that we're pretty encouraged by what we've seen over the weekend with people really being willing to show up. there's definitely a few groups active down here that are doing really great, great work. And I think it's a good time to point out that, you know, anti-fascists do like, I mean, we do a lot that's not just showing up in black. And a lot of that work really is in the community, building solidarity with the people that we live with. And I think that that kind of ground game that's been going on in Southern California over the last few years has really bore some fruit for us. That's been really great.
Awesome.
But it's still hard. It's still difficult for people to get around the metro. It's not like the Bay Area where you can just hop on BART and get from San Francisco to fucking anywhere, really, in 45 minutes, right? But it's not the case here. You know, there's no rail that goes to Huntington Beach. We're lucky that there's a rail that gets between Long Beach and L.A., if that gives you any indication of how shitty it is here to get around. Yeah, so
just imagining that Simpsons episode where the monorail guy comes in.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's not to say that there are other cities that have it worse. I mean, I lived up in Seattle, and, you know, they're compact, so it's still easier to get around. Even though we're spread out, it has, even in the last 2 years, I've seen more and more leftists come out of their shells.
Well, ideally, I mean, we need to be building so there's a, you know, there's a crew or there's a group in every neighborhood, you know, or at least there's a person that's there, that's based there, that knows people. Because, I mean, that's when groups are really successful, when you have, you know, people that are spread out that can really, you know, have their fingers in the dirt, so to speak, of what's going on. I mean, that's always the sign of really a successful group, when you have people that really know the terrain all over. Because, I mean, you know, at the same time, I mean, you can't be everywhere at once. You can't just be constantly running around.
Right, and, right.
Like absolutely. You said, I mean, the L.A. region is huge. I mean, even people in big cities, I mean, sometimes don't go to other neighborhoods or other parts of the city because it does take so long to get around, either driving or on public transportation. And, you know, you can't always do that.
I rarely go to L.A.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a 30-mile, and you know, I even ride a motorcycle. My trips to L.A. are very limited. I tend to stay in Long Beach. I have everything I need here.
For sure.
I love this city, and that's kind of why I do what I do. I want to keep it the way it is. And for the most part, you know, Long Beach is pretty diverse. You know, there's Lakewood's the town, the neighboring city, where it's a little bit of a hotbed, but we're looking into that.
Yeah. Nothing organized up there. But.
Yeah, there's nothing organized. Right. Lakewood, we kind of consider anything that's in the 562 area code ours, I guess, because we know the area. And that stretches from Long Beach, Lakewood, Bellflower, and Norwalk. Mm-hmm. So it's a few cities that we kind of
keep an eye on.
Yeah, keep an eye on.
Cool. Well, speaking of Long Beach, let's now talk about what happened the next day. There was supposed to be a rally by the United Patriot Front.
National Front.
Yeah, United Patriot National Front.
Okay, United Patriot National Front, which includes Antonio Foreman and is kind of like, I don't know how you would describe it. It includes like some people that would probably describe as white nationalists, but then also some patriot types. But they seem to be kind of like trying to make a California version of Three Percenters meets kind of like Bay Stickman fighters, something like that. But they were supposed to have a rally on Sunday. They originally announced it on Facebook, and then they kind of pulled out, maybe, but people still held a rally. So just walk us through what all happened.
I think, you know, the community got word of the UPNF rally, I mean, very quickly. Not just us, but like that neighborhood got wind of it pretty quickly. You know, I know that there were flyers handed out, and a lot of different groups were doing just getting information out there. I think that, you know, for for us, we're all about like letting the neighborhood know and letting the neighborhood organize and giving support, but empowering the neighborhoods to actually defend themselves, so to speak. So yeah, I think within about a week of this, the counter organizing starting, I think that's when we noticed that the page went down, maybe a week or two.
Yep.
That they took down the event. Then maybe like a week later, they changed their name to Everything Patriot and Tactical, which is a little hard to not laugh at when you say it. And, you know, we monitored the event for a while. I don't think it ever had more than 10 people going, maybe not even more than five.
It didn't even have more than five.
It never really gained traction. It seemed like a weird move to us, you know, like in the same way that I talked about Huntington Beach really being pretty deep in their territory. Long Beach is not a place that you're going to gain a lot of traction with an event like that. I mean, there is that some of that kind of activity, but it's not. It seemed foolish to us when we saw it. We were like, "This can't be." I mean, this can't be happening. But we don't give an inch to that kind of stuff. If they say they're coming, we'll turn out. No question. So. As it got closer to the event, our thought was this is a great way to get the community out.
Send a message.
Send a message, like, you know.
To them.
Coming or not, like, we're going to turn out. We kind of thought of it as, like, our Stone Mountain, so to speak. Like,
but not so much.
Well, so they could push back from their own movement, too, when they say they're going to do something and they don't show up or it just kind of falls flat. I mean, people recognize that and they call them on that, and you'll see it in the comments because these people literally post their entire lives on Facebook. But, you know, they'll tell them, like, you know, why should we come out to your events? Can you just call for stuff and then you back out or, you know, it doesn't fall through?
We were kind of concerned about being the boy who cried wolf. You know, the Nazis are coming, and then they never showed up. But, we played it right. We kind of just gave the information to the community, and the community just took it upon themselves to do whatever. What was the name of the group? The United Anti-Racist Neighborhood Front or whatever. They kind of just popped up.
That's awesome.
They were mostly DSA folks. I don't know. But they popped up, and, we just kind of sat back and watched the community organize, you know, because that's kind of the approach we're taking, is that we don't want to be looked at as organizers, I guess. We want to be seen as the people who bring you the information about Nazis in the area. And that's kind of our focus. But we don't organize, but we'll show up, right? That's kind of how we look at it. I don't know. That's how I look at it.
That's how I look at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we let other groups organize. We want to take that anonymity to the max, is what it is.
Yeah. I think we're really lucky in that our local Long Beach DSA chapter is I say it, they're just a little more radical, I think, than kind of that org tends to be. And so I mean, obviously, like, their politics are for me. Nobody in our group really is really into like the meat and potatoes of what their politics are. But I mean, yeah, they turn out and they just have a lot of really great people. So I think that allows us to kind of let them take the lead on some things. I don't know if that's how you'd say that.
That's fine. They are pretty radical here. That's all I can say. They're much different than the LA DSA, much different than the OC DSA. So yeah, we are kind of lucky that we have them here.
Awesome. Well, anything else you want to say on that mobilization? There were certainly some cool pictures of different banners and stuff like that. Looks like a lot of people were out there. And also just really awesome to see whenever there is like a broad coming together. And I think that honestly just makes people so much safer, is when there's beforehand planning, people getting on board. And I don't know, also just people, you know, talking to each other, you know, learning new skills, learning how to organize, learning how to mobilize people. I mean, those are all good things.
There's one thing that that should, I guess, be brought up is that there were two different rallies on Sunday. There was our rally that we held on Bluff Park, and then we had another group, I think it was, what do they call, the Long Beach Area Peace Network? I think that's what they're called.
Yeah.
They held their little rally. They just, they didn't want to risk any confrontation with Nazis, which, you know, is understandable. But they held their rally at a different park, which is on the same boulevard, just kind of as like quarter mile north or whatever. But that one had a little, that one was probably just as big as ours, because a lot of, who was the other group that was there? It was PSL, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
PSL, I think it was.
It was PSL. We don't really work with PSL here. They're just too authoritarian for us. But they did hold their own rally, and it was interesting that there were more police surveillance around their park than there was around ours. We had the one mobile camera tower that had the four cameras on it. That's all we had in our area. And then going over there, it was a little bit more surveilled, which I found kind of interesting. But maybe it was because PSL was there. I don't know.
Okay, we are back again for another week. So what is going on with Trump? Is he having a bad time? It seems like there was a period right when the Mueller report came out, and that it seemed that the Republicans were very happy with the results. Obviously, there was the lawyer man that Trump appointed that was like, yes, this totally exonerates the president. Now it seems like things are shifting. I mean, it's so hard to really tell what's going on with just the spectacle of all this crap. I mean, you've got Fox News on one side, CNN on the other. They're all trumpeting either, you know, one political party or one position. So what do you make of this? What's going on with Trump? There's been a couple of things that's been happening.
Yeah, so the Mueller report came out. The kind of timeline of events is that the Mueller report was released to the Justice Department, right? William Barr, who is the Attorney General, who was just appointed maybe 2 months ago, him and Rod Rosenstein, who probably is a name people know, he was the acting Attorney General overseeing the special counsel's investigation for, you know, the last 2 years or so. They sort of seemingly assembled a team at the Justice Department to kind of power through the report, and then they wrote this four-page summary. And the four-page summary essentially says, hey, we looked at the report. There's no indictable evidence that would indicate any sort of direct agreement between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And there is evidence of obstruction, but not enough to indict. And that letter came out, and that made the administration very happy. And they went on the air for a week and a half talking about how they were completely exonerated. And, you know, all of their surrogates were kind of putting forward the same line. All of the hosts on Fox News are putting forward the same line. There was a very coordinated kind of media messaging strategy that was rolled out after the summary was released. Although Barr says it wasn't a summary. He's very, very definitive about that. This isn't a summary. It was a summary for as much as he doesn't want it to be portrayed that way. But then the report came out. And when the report came out, pretty much every journalist in the country that covers politics spent all weekend just reading the thing. I'm still only about halfway through myself because there's a lot of information in there. The report is 448 pages long and is very dense and very detailed, and runs through all kinds of, you know, illegal or pseudo illegal activity that might have happened. So that report, it speaks to the activities of a large number of people that were involved in the campaign, and the administration afterwards, as well as the transition team and so on, and specifically hones in on a number of really key characters, right? So one of those characters is Dan McGahn. So Dan McGahn used to be White House counsel. What's important about that role is that White House counsel is not the president's personal attorney. The president's personal attorney, up until he gave information to investigators, was Michael Cohen. Dan McGahn was White House counsel. What White House counsel is supposed to do, what their job description is that they are supposed to inform the president about their legal rights as president. They're not supposed to advocate for the president's policies. They're not supposed to be involved in policy making. Their only job primarily is to be the person that a president can go to and say, yo, I want to do this thing. Is it legal? Dan McGahn was a core figure in the report, and it's pretty clear that a lot of the information in the report came from him. He was told by the administration when Ty Cobb was the president's personal lawyer dealing with this to testify to the Mueller team, and so he did. And what McGahn runs through is he's particularly prominent in the obstruction section, which is section two. He runs through a number of instances where he was told to do illegal things, refused to do them, and then told to lie about being told to do them. There's at least three different instances where he almost quit over being told to do illegal things. He talks about how he was told to fire the special counsel, how he was told to fire Robert Mueller, and instead wrote his resignation letter up and was talked out of it the last minute by Reince Priebus. There's all these stories centered around Dan McGahn and very, 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 very clear moments where he himself was the thing that stopped obstruction of justice from happening. Other figures are focused on the report are Jared Kushner, who is portrayed as entirely aloof and completely inept. Donald Trump Jr., who's portrayed as a person who knows literally nothing about politics, but is willing to do anything to try and get information to win. Michael Cohen factors very prominently, especially in the section about the Trump Tower Moscow. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who factors into the report in a number of really interesting ways, one of which is a section in which they describe how, in her testimony to the special counsel, she admits to having lied to the press at the press conference after James Comey was fired about why James Comey was fired. And that she knows that James Comey was fired because he refused to be loyal to the president, which in this case also involves a Russia investigation, which would be obstruction of justice. But she told the press that he was fired because FBI agents hated him, and then doubled down on that the next day, and then told the special counsel's office that she knew she was lying about that. So what that's all led to is a lot of legal ambiguity. There's a lot of people now that are sitting there going, you know, specifically like moderate conservatives. And there have been a couple of articles released in the last couple of days where either people from the transition team or people who worked on the campaign or people who are just Republican operatives have written these articles saying, look, I was kind of on the fence about this whole Trump administration thing, but now I'm in favor of impeachment, which is not a great sign. And that was actually kind of the turning point for Nixon, is when Republicans started turning on him. There have been a number of people that have changed their party affiliations in the fallout from this, but I think the most important kind of the first most important element of this is that after the summary was released, Trump's poll numbers didn't move at all. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but the summary was released and Trump's approval rating stayed exactly the same, which shows that there were a lot of people that just don't like the guy. And it really didn't have anything to do with the Mueller investigation. Once the report came out, though, his approval rating dropped, depending on the poll that you're looking at, somewhere between 5 and 7 points. And that's a significant drop to happen in a week. And what that's indicating to a lot of people that are looking at this is that there were a lot of moderate Republicans that were on the fence about Trump, and they're looking at this now and going, there's literally no way we're going to support this guy anymore. So that's one element of this. The other element of this is that a lot of people inside this administration testified to the special counsel. And there's a lot of things in that report that are pretty damning. And every time there's a major leak in the Trump administration, pretty much the response is to shut down everything and just try and find out who the leaker is. The problem is that this time it's everybody. So everybody's the leaker, and they're cited in the report. And what that's led to is Trump essentially existing in an administration where he can't trust anybody because everybody snitched on him, essentially. And he doesn't come out of this.
And everybody also thinks that he's a little baby. And yeah. Also that they have to keep things from him.
Yeah. And that's also talked about in the report.
I mean, it's a very strange spectacle because, it's almost hard to remember back to the beginning of the campaign. But, I mean, I feel there's so many correlations between Trumpism and Maoism when you think about it, because so much importance is put on the leader, but also like the leader needs the little people to kind of rise up and like attack the weak and like decadent elements within the state to like make the leader strong. But there was just so much, you know, you hear these people that were in the administration, you know, in the early days, just like fawning over Trump. But then when it came out in reality, like in the actual channels and the actual White House, people were just like, this guy's an idiot. He's a little baby. You know, we're just going to use him for whatever we want. And it's such a bizarre spectacle.
I think the difference here, though, is that in the past, both the administration and a lot of Trump supporters wrote those stories off as fake news, right? So it's fake news media, blah, blah, blah. People are just trying to damage the president, so on. The difference is that even the Justice Department came out to say the integrity of Robert Mueller and the investigation is unimpeachable. Everything that was done exactly by the book. And actually, in the report, they cite DOJ prosecution guidelines a number of times. Very specifically, they're like, on this line, on this page of these DOJ guidelines, it says this, and this is why we made this decision. It's very, very, very precise. And so at this point, there's a lot of people who are sitting there going, well, so people were saying this stuff the whole time, but here's an actual official source, like a real official source. And for people that trust the government, for whatever that's worth, someone like Robert Mueller is almost infallible, right? And so when he comes out with a report like this, that holds a lot more weight than, say, Bob Woodward, right? Because Bob Woodward is a liberal Washington Post journalist and like all this stuff. There's many ways to write him off. It's really difficult to write off Robert Mueller and a lot of the people that were working on the investigation. And so I think for a lot of people that were sort of in denial about what's going on, this was kind of a reality check. The report is way worse than a lot of people are trying to portray it as being. Essentially, what the report comes out and says is that the only thing that stopped the Trump campaign from coming to an official agreement with the Russian government to help them in the election was their own ineptitude. It wasn't that they didn't want to do it. It's that they kept failing to close the deal. And actually, in a couple of cases, specifically around the Trump Tower meeting, the famous Trump Tower meeting of 2016, what's said in the report is, yeah, this is hella illegal, but in this case, the defendants would have to know that they were breaking the law, and we can't prove that they know anything about laws. So we just can't charge them because they don't know about laws, even though they were running a presidential campaign. Right? So essentially what they say is that's a massive violation of campaign law, and the campaign chairman was there, but no one knows about laws, so we can't charge them. That's a pretty thin justification for not charging someone. Valid, but thin, and not exactly the best look for the administration. So what that's led to is Trump doing what Trump does, which is kind of circling up the firing squad and telling everyone to shoot, seeing who comes out on top, and then trying to cause controversy in public to distract attention. The difference is that this news story is so big, it's not going away. Anytime soon.
What's funny is the argument that, like, well, we tried to obstruct, but we didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that comes up a number of times. It's like, they tried. I mean, there's an entire 2 or 3 page long section, which is
they just... even failed at obstruction.
Yeah, they failed.
That's how well the Trump presidency is going. We can't even obstruct.
Well, and they failed at getting actual direct coordination with the Russian government. Like, there's a 2 or 3 page long section, which is just about Michael Cohen trying to negotiate a meeting with Vladimir Putin to talk about election coordination under the auspices of a Trump Tower Moscow discussion. What's amazing about that is that the reason that never happened is that Michael Cohen tried to email the deputy prime minister of Russia and got the email address wrong. That's why it didn't happen. And then he never followed up. Yeah, that's just ineptitude at that point. Like, there was absolutely intent. They just weren't good enough at things.
Did they say what the email was? It was like, Russia 135 star.
Yeah, well, it was something, the email they described the content was something like, hey, we've got this business deal. We really want to see that go through. By the way, there's also this election thing, and I'd really like to meet you guys. Essentially, right? And there were a number of different attempts to do this, and they all fell apart, either because their intermediaries didn't know the people they said they knew, or they sent the email to the wrong person, or in one case, Trump was supposed to go to what essentially is the Russian version of the World Economic Forum. He had actually gotten an invite, and they were processing his visa application. This is while he was running for president. It's in, like, summer of 2016. After the Republican convention, right? He was going to go to Moscow for this meeting to have a secret meeting with Vladimir Putin about politics. And he ended up canceling it at the last minute because he didn't know he was supposed to go. His, like, secretary had helped set it up, and Michael Cohen helped set it up. And then when he found out about it, he was mad. So he canceled the trip.
That reminds me of the time Trump went to France and refused to, like, go to, like, honoring, like, the World War One soldiers, and he was like, "Fuck it, I'm not gonna go. It's raining. It'll." He said it'll fuck up my hair. And I was like, "That's a really bad idea." And, like, everyone shit on him for it. And then, like, after it was over, he realized, like, how much he had messed up, and then he tried to blame it on everybody else.
Well, and so the big takeaway story that a lot of people are going back to is this moment in which Trump finds out that the special counsel is appointed. And apparently, according to sources, he slumps back in his chair and says something like, my presidency is over, I'm fucked.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that might be the most salient kind of coherent moment of his entire presidency, because what's happening now, and we actually are starting to enter into potentially really dangerous territory here, because Trump's reaction to any sort of resistance is always to double down and cause tragedy, to try and distract attention away. The difference this time is that the crisis is much bigger than the prior crises. You already have Elizabeth Warren on the campaign trail talking about impeachment. You've got numerous people in the House talking about impeachment. You've got Republicans talking about impeachment. This went from essentially a criminal question to a political question, which he's losing a lot of ground on. that in fact the only way he won't be impeached at this point is if the Democrats decide that the presidential election's coming up and they just don't want to waste the time
to do it. Oh, I don't think they do. I don't think they're going to engage in impeachment.
I don't think they will either, but he's not going to be saved because there's no grounds. He'll be saved because the Democrats don't want to distract attention away from the presidential election.
Yeah.
And they want to run on issues, not on the Russia investigation, which is whatever. But that will be the thing that stops him from being impeached. And the reality of this is that his response to this, which has been stonewalling all the congressional investigations, right? He's refused to allow anyone, either current or former administration personnel, from testifying in front of any House committee. He won't release documents. He's got Steve Mnuchin at this point. Steve Mnuchin is technically violating a congressional subpoena as of today, because the tax returns, Trump's tax returns, were subpoenaed today, and Mnuchin was told not to release them and said that he'll make a decision by May 6th. He is technically in contempt of Congress right now. The Treasury Secretary is in contempt of Congress right now, right? And this is following a period of time where there was already a bunch of churn in the Department of Homeland Security. People were already jumping ship. I mean, essentially what's going on at this point is we're watching an administration which was already in the process of implosion start to implode much further, but do so much more violently and much faster than they had before. Everything from this point forward from them is going to be about confrontation. And that's what they're going to end up running on in 2020, is they're going to run on, we're not socialists, this is a referendum on socialism, and look at what the deep state did to me. They tried to destroy me, but I won. That's what they're running on.
But I think in some ways, I mean, I don't want to get too inside baseball. Let's, you know, talk about presidential politics too much. But I think that in some ways, if they do that, what they will do is they will basically, just how the Democrats were like, you know, at least we're not Trump. You know, yep. Then they'll make it, at least we're not socialism. And then they basically pivot and make everything about, you know, socialism and everything the socialists are saying, which a lot of people right now, like we talked a little bit, I think, about this last week with the Bernie's town hall and Fox News. I mean, a lot of people are liking the the less class war type stuff. I mean, they're enjoying that.
Yeah, they're kind of digging it. And so I think what Trump is seeing, and I'm sure what his campaign staff is seeing.
I mean, but not only that, but I mean, even when he himself, like, ran on, you know, kind of pseudo some of the same stuff. I mean, you know, I'm not going to attack Medicare. I'm not going to attack Medicaid. We're going to, you know, we're going to get out of some of these bad global trade deals. You know, we're going to redo Obamacare into something better. I mean.
Mm-hmm. And so the fallout from this report is, if you're Trump, you're sitting there going, I'm surrounded by people I can't trust. I'm surrounded by people that I thought I knew and I thought were loyal, but clearly aren't. My presidency is under threat now. And he's running behind in a presidential election Joe Biden is probably going to announce on Thursday from all the news reports that came out today. And both Biden and Sanders are pulling ahead of Trump right now. Yeah. So he's not doing super great. The thing I'm concerned about is stonewalling congressional investigations is one thing. It's a bad look, but it's not dangerous. What I worry about is what he's going to be doing around the border.
Right.
To try and force a distraction, or what he's going to be doing in the realm of foreign policy to try and force a distraction, because that is the one and only thing that will save Donald Trump's presidency at this point, will be him being able to distract everybody so much that they forget about this. But the chances of that happening are so small that they're almost imperceptible.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, if it's along the lines of immigration, he's going to get a ton of pushback. If he does anything militarily, he's going to get pushback from his own base, because half the thing that he ran on was that, you know, I'm a isolationist, I'm against all these wars, we should be getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, which obviously he hasn't done. I mean, the idea of Trump as somehow an isolationist president or, you know, a non-interventionist is just, you know, so laughable. And I encourage people to go back and listen to our interviews with the journalist Abby Martin if you want to hear the case of Trump the warmonger. But I mean, it's a joke. You know?
Yeah, but essentially what has set in, and I think this is kind of the moral of the story of the last week, what is set in is a siege mentality. The Trump administration views themselves as under siege, and they're not incorrect about that at this point. The difference is that they're under siege in their own minds, it seems, both internally and externally. Trump is essentially shielding himself from every possible danger. And this is this moment where the siege moves internally and you feel under threat from people inside your own castle walls. That was the turning point for Nixon. And it was after that point that everything fell apart for him. You also saw a similar thing play out with Bill Clinton when he was under impeachment. He also isolated himself due to an inability to trust his own staff. And so when that happens, presidencies tend to flounder. Now, Bill Clinton's didn't, but Nixon certainly did. And Trump's definitely is in like heading in that direction, right? Even more so than it already is. And those are the times when these people get the most dangerous, is when they're backed into a corner. Because keep in mind, people that run for president generally are remarkably egotistical, have an incredibly high opinion of themselves, obviously. They wouldn't in any way be able to make the argument that they can speak for 400 million people otherwise, because it's an absurd argument. But most importantly, and I think for all of us, the most important thing to keep in mind is that these people also command military, federal police, intelligence agencies, all these things. They have all these apparatuses at their disposal to cause damage with if they so choose to. The thing that concerns me at this point, and the thing that I will be paying attention to as we go forward, is right now the Trump administration's reaction to this is relatively incoherent, right? They're kind of flailing around everywhere, trying to gain any foothold they can. It won't stay that way. At some point, they're going to get a foothold and they're going to start trying to move forward again, but they're going to do it with a lot more resentment and a lot more anger and a lot more sense of threat than they had going into the last couple of weeks. And yeah. That is when they get the most dangerous, right? That's the thing I worry the most about. And that's the thing that we should all be ready to be paying a lot of attention to and be ready to push back against, because the reaction from the administration could be relatively violent and relatively severe. And I think we all be
that. Well, that's a good point too, because I mean, they could get to the point where him and Stephen Miller could be like, you know, fuck it, we're not going to win. You know, what can we do? You know, how many turns can we?
They'll decide to make some last ditch play to win, right? That they'll militarize the entire border even more than it is, or they'll, you know, put the military at all the border checkpoints and like prevent people from crossing on foot, or they'll, you know, do something ridiculous and over the top, right? Prevent people from Mexico from coming into the United States at all, right? Something like that.
Yeah.
As a last-ditch effort. And right now, they've already done so much horrendous shit that their last-ditch effort is going to be potentially really horrendous, like catastrophically bad. And that's a thing. I mean, I think a lot of people are starting to get to the point where they're starting to mark off where their final red line is before they start to really get out into the streets again. I think the burnout's kind of worn off a little bit. The burnout from the first year or two of the Trump administration has kind of worn off a bit. but whatever red line people are setting, especially anything around immigration, just be prepared for them to cross it completely. And be prepared to react to that, because, it's potentially going to get very bad. That's what I would predict coming up in the next couple of weeks, is they're going to do something totally over the top.
Did you watch at all any of the Jordan Peterson Zizek debate?
Yeah, two old white guys talking about how like capitalism is the only possible way that things can go forward. One guy saying that sucks and the other one saying that's fine. That debate.
I really wanted to spend some time on this because I feel like, I felt in anarchy Twitter land, there was a very healthy dose of kind of just like kind of the rolling of the eyes and like really like this is, you know, this is our generation's Foucault versus Chomsky or something like that.
Except Foucault versus Chomsky had a point and was actually a useful debate about the concept of utopianism and the notion of human nature and concepts of philosophical essentialism. This debate had none of that. Like, there was
for sure
nothing meaningful said during the entire thing.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there was a little. There's a lot of interesting dynamics. I also thought, like, interesting. Like, it seemed how well received Zizek was by a lot of Jordan Peterson fans. It seemed they had never like seen him debate somebody that wasn't like a trope of like a crying person screaming about safe spaces or something like that they saw in a meme.
That whole thing, because the whole premise of the debate was about happiness and the concept of socialism, right? And Peterson goes into this debate very clearly unprepared, right? It was likened by a reporter from The Guardian to a professor who forgot to prepare for their 9 a.m. class and just like shows up and just wings it. It's also very clear that Jordan Peterson's never actually read any communist literature.
He never read the Communist Manifesto, but he also said something interesting. He said, you know, I came here basically thinking I would say communism has killed way more people than capitalism. Like, how can you argue in favor of communism? But then Zizek also went up there and said, you know, I actually am not really, I don't really care that much about Marxism per se. I'm not really here to like present like a different vision of the world, more or less. And I think that that kind of, I mean, that's where they seem to kind of agree, that more or less like a capitalism plus maybe some amount of social democracy was essentially like the way that things should be. And even if it sucks, like, what else was there?
Yeah.
Like, what else could there be? And then like Zizek's thing was like, at some points he was kind of like thinking mythically about some like sort of like Stalinist past where like some sort of leader like made everybody free, or at least provided enough for everybody so there wasn't want. But I mean, also, like, you know, he brought up global warming and he just said like, I'm not hopeful for the future, I'm a total pessimist. Like, he said something like, the future is like a train coming towards us and I don't see any way for us to get out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, so just for some background on like Zizek's trajectory, because he's like one of those figures that I think got very popular for all the wrong reasons, but actually has made some interesting theoretical points over the years. I'm in no way a Zizek fan, definitely not a fanboy, and think that he probably stopped writing meaningful stuff like 5 or 6 years ago. But early on in his writing career, he always laid out this concept that is actually not very dissimilar from other sort of arguments against postmodernity or post-structuralism as a body of thought. And postmodernity is a historical period. But he would say, look, with the advent of the postmodern age and with the advent of post-structuralist thought, what's been lost is the grand narrative that's supposed to unite us all with purpose, right? And that grand narrative for Zizek was always Leninism, right? Now, keep in mind, Zizek's from Slovenia. He grew up in the former Yugoslavia in a Marxist state, right? So, like, this isn't that out of the ordinary for someone from specifically Yugoslavia, which wasn't super awful or as awful as the Soviet Union, to say. But so he always has this idea that, like, ideology is a problem, right? Problematic construct, but the narrative that's constructed by ideology is a fundamentally uniting force that gives us meaning, right? And that's kind of where he starts his sort of discourse or his project. During Occupy, he had come to this position where him and Alain Badiou were talking about how really what we were seeing in the Arab Awakening movements and with Occupy was this kind of reawakening of a new resistance, right? A resistance which was decentralized. And because of that decentralization, again, Badiou is a Maoist, right? So also keep that in mind. Their arguments, and they made them in separate books, but their arguments essentially were, look at all these people doing Occupy stuff. This is great, but they don't really have a goal. So they have to have a goal, and the goal needs to be communism, right? Like authoritarian state communism. And then all of that fell apart, right? Occupy collapsed. The Arab Awakening movement sort of imploded into, in a lot of cases, their worst possible outcomes. And Badiou pretty much stopped. I mean, he hasn't released a significant work since then. Zizek fell into First trying to defend the idea of utopianism in the face of the reality of it not being possible, and then moved into this whole, well, utopianism doesn't really matter anymore, I'm a pessimist now. And it's not that interesting of a trajectory, really. I mean, he starts off as an academic. Academics tend to be idealists, right? They tend to not be people that engage directly with the things that they're studying or writing about. But they just sort of look at them at a distance. And anyone that's ever been in high-level academia, that is almost morality to have that analytic distance, which is a problem. But that aside, it is a morality that most graduate students are taught. So he comes from that position. But as he gets involved in more meaningful ways in politics, he becomes a pessimist, right? How many people do all of us know that started off as radicals and, like, because we didn't win the revolution in the first 5 years of their activity, they quit and just decided to just sit around and just become hipsters or pessimists or whatever? There's thousands of people like that all over the United States. And what was interesting is that he's articulating this position, which is very similar to Jordan Peterson's position, which is like, in this case, and this is not something he usually talks about, but in this case, his position was, capitalism still kind of sucks, but it's, I mean, he takes the traditional position. It's the only possible way, right?
Well, he said it sucks, but it's the best possible system we have considering the other options.
And that is such a generic, meaningless argument, right? It's essentially what that argument is saying is that Jordan Peterson, which he's an arrogant piece of garbage, so like it's not surprising he has this mentality about things, but essentially that entire argument is, I, Jordan Peterson, have come to see the entirety of human possibility in all possible moments for the totality of all history, and I've decided that capitalism is the only possible good, slightly good way of moving forward. It's an entirely absurd argument. But keep in mind, Zizek's argument during this was not any less absurd, right? The entire pessimist position is, again, coming from this perspective of, I have understood the totality of all strategic and tactical deployment that can happen in a revolutionary context, and have decided that they all fail. Right? These arguments that you see people like Zizek and Jordan Peterson making are, in a lot of ways, an outgrowth of the same academic structure that gave them prominence. Right? That the entirety of academia, and there are people who resist this, obviously, right? I'm sure all of us have had college professors who very much resist this if we've gone to college, or high school teachers who very much resist this. But there is an idea, especially in the university system, that professors exist as almost a sort of priestly class, right? A sort of caste of people that are cloistered away behind the walls, who their sole job is to understand the totality of a subject and speak on that authoritatively. Couched in the narrative of universal truth, right? The problem with that is that it assumes that all academics somehow exist from a point of perspective which is universal, namely not who they are, where they are, but from a perspective of making the claim, at least implicitly, that they've come to understand the totality of all possible things in relation to a specific question. That mentality breeds an extreme level of arrogance. And that extreme arrogance is what we really saw on display during that debate. And there was nothing but that. It was two guys trying to make the claim that they've understood that social change is impossible. They've understood the entirety of history and the entirety of possibility. And they've come to the conclusion that everything's bad. And really all we can do is hope for the best outcome given the conditions that we have now. Not only is that a historically blind, absurd perspective on the level of history, not only is that a perspective which completely misunderstands human dynamics, the construction of events, the dynamics of things, and politics, but it's also a perspective born entirely out of academic arrogance.
In Peterson's case, it really comes down to, like, clean your room, you know, better yourself, like, you know, just some, like, stupid, like, bumper sticker liberal, like, change will come from within. Like,
sure. But underlying all of that with Jordan Peterson, and I think that this is the important element of what people miss all the time with him. Is he a sort of like academic hack, kind of substandard academic who's writing self-help books now to make money? Yeah, sure he is. Yeah, absolutely. But that entire idea that he can talk to, quote, men and tell them how to live is grounded, again, in this idea that he's understood the totality of all possible forms of life and has decided that this is the best one and that everyone should just follow along. It also screams academic arrogance, right? And the thing that I really hope coming out of this Peterson-Zizek debate is that people realize that when you get two prominent people in a room, that doesn't always mean that they ever have anything to say. And that prominence in a modern capitalist media landscape doesn't actually equate to the quality of content. That we did have the Foucault-Chomsky debate back in the day, and that was a meaningful debate between two people who had very different ideas about concepts of human nature and politics and utopia, and there were really, really interesting discussions that are still going on because of that debate. If we could think of the thing that is the exact opposite of that, it would have been this. This was a sort of meaningless piece of trash where, like, two arrogant academics got into a room and just sort of talked at each other for a while,
right,
and came to a meaningless conclusion.
Two things I would say is that, I mean, I think this is, you know, obviously could be said about a lot of like libertarian or people that are really in favor of capitalism or, you know, take that on as part of their like main ideology. It's just like how silly I think it is that people believe that capitalism is the system in which like kind of like individual creativity and like new ideas and like new things somehow are produced. Whereas like on a mass scale, like that's the exact opposite of what actually happens. I mean, most people just get up and they mundanely go to work or try to make profit for someone else. The idea that capitalism is somehow this, like, you know, this system in which, like, such amazing things are produced and new ideas flourish and, like, yeah, you know, the problems of humanity are somehow solved by the market. I mean, that's not even, like, how innovation, like, as we're seeing it, like, you know, on this show we talk a lot about all the time, like, automation. And, like, what's pushing that is, like, to catch up to Amazon to, like, get, you know, fucking everything from, like, you know, frozen salmon steaks to dildos like shipped across the country faster. I mean, that's what's like driving it, as opposed to like, you know, figuring out how to like make, you know, cancer resistant drugs cheaper or something like that. I mean, it's, I don't know. And also too, just like the, I mean, in my head, communal, anarchistic, ecological, you know, system would actually encourage those things. If the means of existence were held in common, I mean, I think that's the only system that I can imagine in which people would not only have the time, but also would be encouraged and also be in a community of individuals that were also striving to create, you know, to better themselves, to better everyone else, and also had access to those things and the time to do it in.
Well, and I think the thing that stood out to me most, watching some of that footage, was that there's a fundamental assumption in this debate that never came up for question and absolutely should have, which the entire debate was premised on the idea that humans inherently have to organize themselves in mass systems.
Right.
Inherently. Right. That it either has to be capitalism or socialism. Right. That we have to have some sort of singular form of organization that is imposed on all of us, that we all abide by, that exists in some sort of historical perpetuity. It's an absurd idea, right? And even though we approach how we live now in that way, right, we talk about the state and systems and things, really at the end of the day, what we're looking at is still an everyday life which is chaotic, dynamic, constantly in flux, changing all the time, right? Historical conditions which are always in flux, always sort of a construction of the things that we all do sort of individually in the world and the dynamics of those actions, right? There's no way to speak about it singularly. The singularity of the system, the quote-unquote the system as we talk about it now, is actually just police. It's law, right? It's the fact that the police can impose a form of life through force in the prison system. That's what allows us to speak about things in singular ways, right? That without the police, that sort of social singularity ceases to exist immediately. And so we as anarchists, right? I mean, it's always strange when I think anarchists use the word systems, right? When we talk about like anarchist systems or something, because at the end of the day, the entire concept here is about the destruction of the impediments to the possibilities of life, and then the ability of people to be able to determine what they're going to do with that possibility, right? Of course, in relation to one another, as we always are, because individualism is an absurdity, existentially. What never got called into question during that debate was whether or not singularity of social systems and concepts of utopia are valid at all as categories to think through. And that, to me, pointed out the sheer academic hackery of this entire discussion, because any valid academic discussion about questions this big would have at least broached that topic, at least somewhat, especially when you're talking about someone like Zizek, who wrote The Sublime Object of Ideology specifically about that exact question. You would think it would come up, but really what I saw was a debate between two really arrogant academics that were too lazy to prepare ahead of time and were kind of just going off the top of their heads because they think that everything they say is super relevant.
Right.
Really what we should be doing is we should be looking at these people and saying, great, this is the death knell of your careers. None of us are going to pay any attention to anything you say from this point forward, because what they displayed on that stage right now during that debate was sheer laziness about relatively meaningful questions.
I was going to say, the only thing I wanted to say is that, you know, look, I understand that things are very bad right now and also complicated, but, and, you know, Zizek brought up, you know, like we need to basically, you know, basically states essentially need to come together and figure out a solution to the climate crisis. You know, at the same time, I mean, I think it's also entirely plausible and realistic too. I think much more so than thinking that, you know, states or the ruling class or capitalism is going to, like, you know, this is what Peterson implied, was that, you know, basically innovation and technology were going to get us out of the problem of, you know, ecological collapse, which of course is, you know, what somebody like him would totally say. Is that it's, you know, it is plausible also to think that, look, there could be a general strike.
Yep.
People can stop working, which is exactly what needs to happen. People just need to stop working. They need to stop reproducing society. They need to stop reproducing society. They need to, we need to take hold of the various things, like, for instance, you know, nuclear power that physically cannot be left alone by itself, and find out ways to dismantle them. And then we need to take control of the means of existence that physically will need to take over and, like, build certain things or, you know, do certain things in order to ensure that we're going to avoid as much as possible climate catastrophe. So that means, like, making machines that, like, take CO2 out of the environment. I think, as much as I do kind of lean more towards an anti-civ direction in some instances, I think, you know, we should be building those things, and we shouldn't be waiting for the government to do it. I think humanity needs to take the reins of their own existence and start building those things. Well, and then also, you know, coming together and deciding, you know, in workplaces, neighborhoods, schools, communities, neighborhoods, you know, the kind of world and alternative that we want outside of wage labor, outside of industrial production, outside of fossil fuels, and putting that into practice. I mean, physically, that's all people need to do. That, and also the other thing of, you know, destituting power, making sure that the state doesn't kill us when people declare autonomy. And that means, you know, getting rid of the ability of the state to police territory.
Yeah. And this is the big question, right? It's like, when are people going to, when all this stuff is going on, sit there finally and decide that there is no one better to run their lives than themselves, right? And that things like climate change are largely the result of us giving that power away.
Right.
Watching other people make decisions for us and then impose those decisions through force. When is it going to be time for people to start to sit there and go, look, we're all about to die. Maybe this is a time for us to take matters into our own hands, because clearly what we've been doing up until this point isn't working at all, in no possible way. You know, like, there's always this discussion, and I get asked this question constantly by people who are, like, you know, trying to be edgy or, like, challenge me in discussions or whatever. They're like, well, I mean, how do we know that, you know, if we eliminate the police, that crime will stop? And my answer always is, whatever you're defining as crime hasn't stopped now with the police and the prison system, right? There's literally no qualitative difference there, right? That if we're going to sit there and say we want to actually fix these problems, very clearly we're the ones that have to fix those problems because we're the only ones that understand what they are. A politician in Washington, D.C. or whatever state capital that you're in can't possibly understand the conditions of your life. And so when does it become time for us to decide that the only people that can understand those conditions are ourselves? And when does it become time for us to start to activate that? Because that's the big question I'm asking myself right now, is how long is it going to be? How far down the trail towards planetary heat death are we going to move? You know, how far down the trail of losing complete control over the security state and being completely at its mercy are we going to move before people decide that it's finally enough? And I think more and more people are making that decision every day. And that's a really good thing, but it's not happening fast enough.
Ended up and left his mouth. The day they laid poor Poncho low, Lefty split for Ohio, where he got the bread to go. There ain't nobody knows. All the federalists say slip away out of kindness, I suppose.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.